podcast discusses issues of illness and health, and whilst we hope it's interesting and maybe helpful, it's not a substitute for a personalised assessment. So if you have concerns about your own health, then we recommend you contact your own medical professional.
Hi, my name's Alex Hordebooth, and welcome back to Invisible Illnesses, the show that unveils information, hints and tips around health issues that hide in plain sight all around us, and aims to provide support to those suffering from them and the people around them. Today's guest is Jill Simpson, an experienced executive coach with a wealth of real-world experience. Before launching her coaching career, Jill spent 2 decades in senior roles across marketing, HR and corporate affairs for major corporate firms. I was lucky to work with Jill for 8 years at Danone, where she broke new ground, combining being a member of the board with also being a part-time working mum. In 2012, she started training as a coach and currently runs the coaching business Chapter 44, working with CEOs, senior leaders, and managers across a range of businesses. If you've never come across an executive coach before, what Jill specialises in is helping people make changes in their working life that they might struggle to deal with without an external perspective. I know from first-hand experience that Jill's approach is practical, empathetic, and genuinely transformative for anyone seeking to address knotty issues in their working lives, even when the main barrier to change is often themselves. I'm excited for this episode because I'm hoping you'll find that she offers some really great insights into how the human mind works, as well as sharing sensible, actionable, really practical strategies you can use every day, whether you're leading a team, managing a household, or both. So brilliant. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us, Jill. It's great to have you on the podcast. And I know that obviously, you know, for the benefit of the listener, you know, we used to work together and I knew you in the days when you and your big corporate role at Danone. But since then, you've done something different. And I wonder if that's a good place to start is just tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of where you are now and your kind of how you got there.
Sure. It's lovely to be here. Thanks, Alex. So I enjoyed a 20-year corporate career. I spent 5 years with a startup and then 15 years with Danone. And I loved it. At that time, it kind of felt like a very happy place to be. I really enjoyed my career. I guess when I look back now with the wisdom I have, having left that world and had a little bit of a break from that, I think what it led to was just a permanent sense of rushing and of work becoming all consuming for me. It felt like work just took over ultimately. I invested so much in my professional self, probably at the expense of other parts of myself. And yeah, I think the reason I stepped away primarily was just to create some more space and to just stop rushing. It was, it's very easy to get into that hamster wheel, I think, in the corporate world of taking on more responsibility, doing bigger projects, leading bigger teams. And it all felt wonderful at the time, but actually in hindsight, I think there comes a point at which that just became too much for me. And it was too intense, the pace was too relentless, and something had to give. And so that was behind my decision to step away.
Can I ask, Jill, is that something you worked out yourself, or did you have help with that? Did you bounce ideas off people or...
It was a bit of both, I think. I realised, I think the change for me came when I became a parent and I had more things in my life that I wanted to give my time and energy to. And so I wanted my career to play a less bigger role than it was, because I wanted to be able to be a good parent and a partner and, you know, have that family life that I'd, wished for. So I think it was partly that led me to question things for myself and say, actually, okay, how is this working out for me? You know, I was fortunate. I returned to work after parental leave part-time. So I had, practically, I had flexibility. I worked 3 days a week initially on my return to work. I think it didn't always feel like I worked part-time because my roles were busy and I was very committed. I was very diligent. I was very conscientious. I wanted to still do a really good job. So I think I held myself to the same professional standards that I had before becoming a parent. And I was just trying to do it all on 3 days a week instead of 5. I took a lot of work home with me. And I mean that in my head, like mentally, I was still very occupied with work, even when I was at home. So I think a lot of it was self-awareness as I kind of went on that journey and thought, hang on a minute, this isn't how I want to be when I'm at home. I don't want to have a head full of work. I want to be able to be present for my family. And there were a couple of moments, you know, that led me to sort of really question that. And I also had the benefit of having a brilliant executive coach to support me when I was in Danone, particularly when I made the step up to a board level role. And I think through those conversations, that also helped me realise that this probably wasn't the future for me long term. And so whilst I loved being at Danone and I loved my board level role there and I learned so much, I kind of came to realise this, I can't do what some of my other fellow board members are doing and be in this type of role for the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. And you know, kudos to you for realising that, because I think it's a common thread in a lot of the stories we've been hearing of that. You know, that you're on the hamster wheel, but you don't even know if the hamster wheel exists. that's a big thing. And as you say, you're fortunate in a way that you had someone to give you that headspace to kind of reflect on where you were and where you were going. So for those people who are listening who don't really know what an executive coach is, like, and that's kind of your role now, right? Like, so could you kind of tell us a bit about what that looks like and how that works?
Yeah, the coaching relationship is a really valuable one, I think. So a coach is there to help create the space for someone to think brilliantly for themselves. So we're not here to tell people what to do. We're not here to give people the benefit of our wisdom. We're here to create space to think, because we don't create space to think in our lives, right? We rarely gift ourselves the time and space, particularly if you're in a busy corporate role, you know, busy professional life. And so it is typically used to help people through change and navigate through change and transitions, major transitions. It's future focused. So whereas other talking therapies might look back on your past and help you understand why you are like you are today, coaching is typically looking at, okay, I'm here today, but I want to be in a different place tomorrow. How do I go from A to B? So you're typically looking forward. And the idea really is just to help expand someone's thinking, to generate new insight, to offer that blend of support and challenge, to really open ourselves up to some deep thinking so that we can find solutions in ourselves to kind of move forward. So the premise is that the coach is the expert at coaching and asking the questions and listening, but the client is the expert on themselves, and only they will know the answers to their own challenges. So our role is to help them discover the answers to their own challenges.
That is really interesting. So it's like that, you know, you're that sort of guide, but you're not sort of giving direct, you're not sort of telling people where to go. You're kind of saying, here are the options available and what motivates you most. And you talked about it there in terms of talking therapy. I mean, is there sometimes a bit of a grey area between what you do and therapy? Because I know we've had, you know, you've done some coaching sessions with me and they've been brilliant, but sometimes there is that bit of, you know, oh, my personal life is coming into this now, and I'm talking about kind of things that I know are my own kind of hang-ups or whatever. That must, does some of that happen for you? Like, you feel like you're almost doing a therapy session sometimes?
Yeah, I think it doesn't necessarily feel like therapy, but I think you've touched on a few things that are really important. So one is that you coach the whole person. I don't coach a work person, I coach the whole person. So it might be we're coaching around a professional topic or around a leadership role or a transition at work, but inevitably we bring all of ourselves into work, right? And so we can't separate those things out. So as a coach, I'm very comfortable bringing in aspects of ourselves outside of work to help us understand how we're performing at work. So, and there are boundaries around coaching, I guess, and those conversations that I contract around. So sometimes we do look at patterns from our past, because that helps us explain our behaviour today. But I'm not an expert in analysing those and sort of getting under the skin of more complex, you know, problems that may have occurred in someone's past. So that's where I would just draw the line and make sure we're focused on it being a coaching conversation rather than a therapeutic one.
Do you ever find it's difficult, Jill, to establish that dynamic that you're not there to tell people what to do? Because that's a frequent problem in my role, but you could see why that might be more the case. There's a traditional kind of model where a patient comes to a doctor to be told, to be given a tablet or to be told what the problem is and what they're going to have to do about it, in a very paternalistic sort of style. Do you have that problem with people coming to you expecting you to provide a solution? Or are people, because the nature of how people engage with you it's already set up that yours is a guiding role rather, or a facilitating role rather than inactive coping, rather than people coming with a passive role expecting something from you?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter, particularly if coaching has been set up well in organisations or with the individuals coming to coaching. Typically, you would spend some time up front explaining what coaching is. And so people have an awareness of it before they sign up to receive it. And therefore, there is an expectation that this person isn't some guru who's going to sit and, you know, tell them everything they want to know. But they are coming as a listening partner and a thinking partner. And therefore, you contract around that right at the start.
And so what's the typical pathway to get to you? Is it people who are, you know, have they reached a point where they're off sick? Are they starting to struggle? Or is it just offered in a very routine way to everybody? How does it happen?
A lot of the time it's offered in a routine way. So businesses that have well-established sort of coaching embedded in their L&D teams as part of their people support would just have coaching available to anybody who wants it. So it's you don't have to be stressed or ill or whatever to trigger it, although that is sometimes a reason to bring in a coach to support someone who's maybe struggling. It's equally for just, you know, high performers who are doing great and just want to be better. We coach graduates who are just starting out in their careers and could do with some help and support to navigate the world of work and getting used to it. So it's not, coaching is not something attached to a stressful, negative illness related, you know, sort of condition. You don't need to be struggling to receive coaching. But more often people who come to coaching have something they're wrestling with. But it could be a positive challenge, not a sort of illness or a particularly negative challenge, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I'm interested because obviously this range of podcasts has started from the point of talking about illness, you know, people who are, you know, coming to doctors and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I've seen parallels between, I guess, the obstacles and solutions that help people with illness get better and people at the other end of the spectrum, sort of high performers to perform even higher. And I wonder what spectrum you've seen. Have you seen people who've gone, because I think people cross that spectrum. I've got people who were very much in the illness domain who you could see were previously extremely high performing people and have crossed, you know, lines all, you know, in terms of how they're feeling and how they're performing, right? Have you seen that? Is that a spectrum that you see? So people, you know, who are maybe off sick at the moment or that kind of thing? Or what kind of spectrum are you seeing?
I guess I see a real mix. I see there are definitely people who are on the same trajectory that I was on, where actually high performing at work, high achievers, I think we learn to value our own success through our achievements at work. And then you just come to a point where you can't just keep striving and striving and striving, that it just, you know, we do burn out, we lose that capacity. And it's interesting how those people then tackle that decline, if you like, or that how do they face that decision that actually what they've been striving for and that pattern they're in is no longer valid or no longer sustainable for them. And I think high performers in particular, it's really hard to let go of that model that they've kind of learned. But in a way, it can also be interesting how they apply that to their sort of recovery, if you like, whether that's recovery from an illness or recovery from whatever challenge they're kind of facing at work. And there's some interesting work that's been done looking at our personal drivers and kind of how we, the models we kind of grow up with based on the messages we've received about ourselves growing up and professionally. And those drivers can be used to really good benefit, but overused, they can become quite harmful in kind of how we recover or how we, you know, choose to kind of choose different pathways, I guess, based on our experiences and where we've got to.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you're kind of almost saying that having spent a lot of time seeing different, it sounds like you've got, you know, what you're saying is there's a real mix of kind of where people are, where they're starting and where you are. But actually through that you see some common themes and you see some common patterns, and one of those is the driver's piece. So, like, you know, how people come to whether it's an opportunity or a challenge and what that means in terms of where their strengths are, but where there are strengths that have become weaknesses, you know, but over time. So could you tell us more about that? How would we describe those different kind of drivers?
Yeah, so there was a piece of work done by a chap called Taibbi Kala back in the 1970s, and he identified five drivers. and I'm sure you'll be familiar with them. I won't go into all the sort of theory behind it, but there are five drivers that essentially the core messages we've received as we've been growing up. So they form our sort of central beliefs about ourselves, and they're our sort of subconscious attempts to behave in a way that we think will gain us the recognition we need from others. So the five that he talks about are the be perfect driver. So we draw energy from doing the right thing, right being in inverted commas. So we aim for perfection in all that we do. We set really high standards for ourselves. We've got the please others. So these people are very understanding. We use our intuition a lot. We notice things that maybe others will overlook. And ultimately, other people's needs trump our own. The try hard driver. So what matters here is effort, not achievement. So these people will get involved in loads and loads of different activities. They're super enthusiastic. They volunteer for things. They go the extra mile. Then we've got the be strong driver. So this person is driven by the need to cope with crises, with difficult people. They'll work steadily through any workload. You can kind of put anything on them and they'll find a way to kind of get through it. So fiercely sort of tough, independent, self-sufficient. And then the hurry up driver. So they like to do everything as quickly as they can. They get loads done. They're energized by deadlines. They always fit loads of extra stuff in. And you can see how each of these drivers, I guess, can serve us really well. If you imagine those things in the workplace, they're really positive traits to have, right? And I'm sure all of us will recognize them in ourselves. And we typically have one or two of these drivers that are more dominant than others. But I think when it comes to then maybe facing challenges or having to do things differently, we rely on those drivers still so heavily that overused, they can become detrimental. So if you think of someone with a be strong driver, so they're fiercely independent, think I need to get through this, I should be able to cope, I'm not going to ask for help because, you know, I should be able to do all this. You can imagine if someone's suffering from a functional illness or has got some symptoms, they're just going to push through. They're just going to be like, you know what, I'm sure I can get over this. I'm sure I can solve it myself. I should be able to deal with this. So they may take longer to recognise symptoms that are maybe problematic. They may push through a lot longer than they should. They may be reluctant to ask other people for help. So whilst that be strong driver can be really useful because it pushes us to kind of seek solutions and pushes us to get better and we can use that and to energize us, it can also have the kind of opposite effect if we rely on it too heavily.
Jill, that ties in incredibly well with our last guest, Tony, who was talking about illnesses like fibromyalgia and chronic pain, where the subconscious bits of your brain are sending you stop signals that tell you that this is not sustainable, and those stop signals are pain and fatigue, and that many people will push. He doesn't mention these drivers, but that many people will continue to push through that because they've got to, because they're looking after a child or an elderly relative, or they just got to push through for their work or their work colleagues or whatever it is, and they don't listen to those stop signals. And what he talks about is that animal part of your brain shouts louder to tell it stop, which means more pain, more fatigue, and it puts more brakes on. And your human brain is pushing the accelerator faster, and your animal brain is putting the brake harder and harder, and the smell of burning is becoming intolerable. And I just think isn't it amazing that him as a consultant anaesthetist working in pain, and you coming from your corporate background, and you these two things just match up so perfectly well. It's very powerful, I think. Anyway, I've interrupted your drivers.
No, it's fine. I think it's a great point, and I think there is I think the way we can manage ourselves, I think it's the same in coaching, is there's no one single solution to these things, or there's no single field that necessarily gives you all the answers. You know, coaching doesn't give you all the answers. You know, probably a trip to your GP isn't necessarily going to give you all the answers. It's about understanding the whole person, and there's so many different elements to that. And so it's lovely to hear that this framework, you know, this particular model has a role to play potentially in this kind of work, just as it does in a corporate setting talking to a leader who's, you know, looking to get promoted or something. It all these things are relevant, right? And they all play their part.
And I think the really important thing there for me is it's both understanding the limitations of the things that you come into the world with and that you have, but equally seeing the value of that, because I'm just thinking about the story you told in an earlier episode, Steve, about a patient you had who was, you know, it was the two illnesses. You had the kind of, and I'm going to probably get this wrong, Steve, but the disease was the same, so they both had hernias. One was kind of relatively kind of relaxed about the timeline and getting better. One was feeling really stressed. He was, ran his own business, was the kind of the strong one in his, was the be strong within his family. And for the one who was putting pressure on himself to get better, that was where there was kind of measurable differences for that individual in how much more pain they felt, how much more difficult the recovery was from exactly the same disease. And I think for some of that, there is a recognition of the, you know, the limitations, but also just, you know, giving yourself a break sometimes, going, well, I'm finding this hard because, you know, these things which are really useful to me and are really valuable, you know, I think sometimes you can end up in that doom loop where you, like, you're not just feeling the effects of it, but you're blaming yourself for being the person who has that driver, and then that's kind of, oh, I've made this problem for myself, and then that's where the kind of circling down happens. I think it's really kind of important to have these models, I think, to help you kind of step out of yourself every now and then and see those patterns.
I wonder if in that case as well, there's a thing about this person's driver's putting pressure on himself. But what that made me think about, Alex, was that this guy had real external pressures on him that he couldn't control, so that he couldn't work, and there were financial stuff. There was, you know, financial stuff that was going to impact on him, and he couldn't play his football, which was, you know, relaxing him and all those sorts of things. So I don't know if you see that, Jill, in terms of there's often, I would have thought patients I see, there's a mixture of kind of self-imposed pressure and high standards and all that sort of stuff that you can control. And then, but there's, for many of my patients, hardest to help patients, is so much powerlessness, genuine powerlessness, lack of control in their lives, extreme poverty and all that sort of stuff. But I imagine even in the high performance world, you have to kind of make some distinction between stuff you can control and stuff you can't control. How do you
totally
deal with that?
Yeah, totally. I think you're right. I think regardless of what we're talking about, the situation you find yourself in, there are always things in any situation you can't control. I remember doing a lot of coaching through the pandemic, and that was a classic example, right, of so many, a situation we couldn't control. You can't control how quickly we're going to get a vaccine or the global death rate, right? There were just horrifying things kind of going on that we couldn't control. And I think what happens is if we focus our attention and energy on the things we can't control, they feel bigger and they get bigger and they sort of consume us. And the skill is always to find the things we can control. There is always something in any situation that you can control. There's a lovely model I use quite a lot in my coaching work that comes from Stephen Covey, and he talks about the circles of concern and the circles of control. So if you were to list out all your worries related to a particular topic or situation you find yourself in, it's to then map them in circles. So you do an inner circle and then an outer circle, and the outer circle is your circle of concern. So they're all the things that worry you, but you have no direct influence over. The inner circle is your circle of influence, and so these are the things that you can do something about. And if you map your worries that way and sort of say, okay, what's in my inner circle? What's in this circle of control? And then focus your energy on those, because if you focus your energy there, that circle gets bigger and it kind of makes the outer circle smaller. So rather than worry breeding worry and us just sort of spending all our time feeling anxious, it's like, okay, let's pick something I can do something about and just focus on that. Because you also then break the problem down and make it a bit smaller and a bit more manageable, which I think is also a helpful technique, right? When people come to coaching very overwhelmed, it's almost the problem feels so big, they don't know where to start or what to do about it. So it's also sometimes just mapping it all out and getting it all out there is then saying, okay, what can you influence? What can we start with? Let's break it down and create these sort of micro steps towards moving forward. Because once you've created some momentum and seen some benefit, that fuels your, I guess, motivation to kind of keep going. Mm. So sometimes it's the small steps and the small wins that can make a big difference on that journey.
Mm. Yeah. And also, I guess, just recognizing those things that are outside your control and you know, naming them as such. I remember I was working for the NHS at the time when the sort of pandemic hit. And one of the, you know, the best pieces of advice I heard was someone just saying, do you know what? I'm going to control the amount of news that I watch, you know, because actually, yeah, as a way of introducing a load of stress and anxiety into your life that you couldn't control, yeah, you had no power over. Of course, you know, you people still want to listen to the news. But it was just manage it. You know, so I'll just listen to it for like 20 minutes or so, and then if you're starting to find that you're becoming a bit overwhelmed by it all, take a break and do something else. You know, do something for yourself. Do something that kind of brings you joy. Because those are still things that are available to us, regardless of where we are and regardless of what's happening. So yeah, I think that's a really, really good bit of advice.
And I think it's about knowing ourselves, isn't it? Coaching is all about self-awareness. And the more we know ourselves and know those things, like you say, what stresses us and what brings us joy. You know, I had friends through the pandemic who would literally sit down at, was it 8 o'clock every night, and watch the latest stats and all those PowerPoint presentations. I didn't watch any of them because I just thought it's not going to give me anything. It's not going to help me through this situation at all. So I just didn't watch them. But I had friends that literally would watch them religiously every night. And so I think it's about knowing what you need in any given situation to help you through it, and that will look different for everybody, right? We're all very unique and we all need different things, but I guess the joy of coaching is to unlock greater levels of self-awareness that make you realize, okay, what do I need to feel strong enough to do this, to feel resilient, to bring joy and to manage my energy well in this situation, and to find that blend for ourselves.
I this is really fantastic. I think this is something I'm actually gonna have to practically bring into the way I consult, to be honest, that Covey thing about the concern and control, just to formalize that. I think I've done it instinctively in informal ways with certain people, but I think there's I certainly talked about overwhelmedness and breaking things down into manageable steps a lot, but I think that gives me a real structure of how I could do stuff differently. And what I found myself thinking is I'm always banging on about that our primal need to be part of a tribe that drives us very hard, and I think the bit that we've kind of assumed but is important to bring to the front of our mind is that these drivers, you said these are things that we've been taught or learnt early in life, and probably we are born with certain traits as well which might drive us to push us to one particular driver rather than to another, but all these are, if we were the only human on Earth, none of these things would even be relevant. So they're all about our interaction with other people. So it's being strong for other people, being perfect for other people, isn't it? So it's all about, because those are the things that we instinctively, without even thinking about it, make us secure in feeling that we're valued as part of our tribe, whatever that tribe is, your tribe at work, your tribe at home, etc. And I just wonder whether part of what you're doing by saying, look at all these things that you're worried about that you can't control, that you're saying to someone, it's okay for you not to be able to, because there's something, even though it's illogical to say to somebody who wants to be perfect that you can't control the death rate from COVID. They know that logically. But is there an instinctive driver in here which just makes us uncomfortable that the world around us is so imperfect and I can't do anything about it? And that just makes you uncomfortable. And I don't know, because I'm not a psychologist, but I just wonder if that's... And to say to somebody, actually, look, you know, maybe something more realistic, at work, you know, the work, like your colleague's gone off sick and you've got more work. It's okay that you can't control that. It's okay that, that you can't... It's all, and then you've got somebody saying to you, because I know that you're not telling people what to do, but you are another human and therefore potentially a tribe person. And that tribe person is saying, it's all right not to be able to do that. And I don't know, maybe that's another thing that sometimes people do, is say, if you were, I've heard other people do this and I've never or rarely done it myself, but if you were somebody else advising you, what would you say about that? So to try and apply that degree of helicopter view or compassion to say, I don't know if that's if that features, but
it's a very great coaching technique. Actually, it's one of the things we use a lot, is sort of that perceptual positioning piece, where you say, actually, if you imagine yourself in another person's shoes. So, and inevitably people are kinder to themselves when they imagine themselves talking to a friend. They would be, no, of course you can't be expected to pick all that work up, or of course you can't do this. But when you're in the moment, in that role yourself, it's much harder to be kinder to ourselves. And I think you touch on something really important there, is we know it rationally. Like if you said to someone, can you ever be perfect? Can you be a perfect parent? Can you be a perfect employee? No, what is perfect anyway? Like define it, you can't. Because it's different to everybody, and it's an unattainable state. And we kind of know that rationally. Our logical brain is like, that's just daft. But because of the messages we've received growing up and kind of what we believe about ourselves, we still strive for it. We still have this drive in us. And I think coaching conversations or any good conversations with people can help you reflect on that and sort of make sense of it in a way that sort of, like you say, it's almost normalizing it and go, you know what, I know you believe that and you think that, but looking at this realistically, you know that's not possible and it's okay for that not to be possible. Mm. And you just sort of, and sharing that lots of other people also feel that. So it is a normal state to be in. It's not something that is unique to you in that sense. There is an overall pattern here. And I think it also helps then to challenge the thinking, because we don't have to hold on to all the thoughts we have, right? Thoughts are just thoughts. We think thousands of thoughts every day. We don't act on all of them, but some of them seem to permeate more than others. So this, if you take the example of someone maybe who's taking on more responsibility at work because a colleague's gone off sick and they think they should be able to just consume all this extra workload. So there we go. There's a should. That's always a clue. When someone says, I should be able to do this, it's always a clue that there's something worth exploring. But it's like, it's just to challenge that thought process and go, well, is it true? You know, is it true that you should be able to cope with all this extra work? And let's just examine that. And then the second question I often ask is, and is it useful to think that? So is it helping you in some way? It might be, because it helps you increase your productivity and it might help you be ruthlessly efficient in your prioritization, and it could lead to some good things. But is it fundamentally useful to keep thinking that all the time, or is that going to lead you to just try and take on too much than you can handle? So the sort of, is it true, is it useful, are two good questions. And if they start to cast out on the thinking, then let's change the thinking.
That's interesting, because that sounds a little bit like some of the principles of CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy. Am I right in saying that you're looking for, you know, yes, there's this enormous external pressure on you and I can see why you're stressed, but there's a little cognitive distortion in there as well, which results in a set of feelings, thoughts or actions that are perhaps not fair or completely accurate or proportionate. And in there is your window of opportunity. That's the thing that you could change. You can't control that external thing, but the thing that you're thinking about it and the thing that you're doing about it, is that really the most helpful, and is it fair and is it accurate? Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And going back to the circles of concern and control, we can control our own thinking. Mm. We just often don't pay attention to it and kind of really challenge it. So if we ask ourselves, is it true, is it useful to think that? If we start to answer no to any of that, we'll change it. Mm-hmm. You know, we can either just stop thinking it, which might sound a bit simple, it's harder than it sounds, or we can reframe that thought into something that's a bit more useful for us. So if we have, for example, an illness and we think, oh, I'm never going to feel better, you know, that is not going to help us. You know, is it true? Are you never going to feel better? I don't know, I might at some point, but right now it feels like I'm not. Is it useful for me to think that I'm never going to feel better? Well, no, because I'm probably going to stop exploring potential solutions. I'm probably going to stop reading around it or asking for help, or all those things. So we accept this sort of defeatist state. Whereas if we shift that thinking into something like, okay, this illness feels really tough right now and I don't know where it's heading, but I'm sure there's something out there that can help me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not saying I'm going to get a miracle cure in a week's time, but it's just shifting from a sort of negative thought into a more neutral one. That then encourages more positive emotion, which encourages more positive action. And then that creates a positive cycle that then reinforces more positive thinking, as opposed to getting stuck in a very negative thinking trap.
Mm. So this is the idea that events themselves are not necessarily good or bad. Is that right?
They're neutral. It's an interesting one, isn't it? It's a bit weird to say all events are neutral, but if you think about, I often use the analogy of being stuck in a traffic jam. Lots of people find being stuck in traffic stressful, but the traffic jam itself is neither good nor bad. It's just a whole load of traffic.
That's really interesting.
Our attitude towards it is the thought process we apply. So I used to drive to work. I live in Bath. I used to have to drive across town. The traffic was always horrendous. And I used to get really stressed and I used to blame the traffic. You know, be like, oh, traffic jam and I'm going to be late for work. So the reason I found it stressful was I'm going to be late for work. The reason that's stressful is I've got an exec meeting at 9 o'clock and I'm not going to get there in time. That to me felt unprofessional, felt like, you know, maybe I'm going to miss an important agenda item. So you start to build this story up in your head, right? So that's the thinking I'm attaching to this event, this traffic jam. It's not that the traffic jam in and of itself is good or bad, but it's going to cause a consequence for me that I perceive to be bad. And so I'm feeling stressed about this traffic jam. Someone in the car next to me might not be in a rush to get anywhere, or maybe they are in a you know, go into a meeting, but they don't really want to be in the meeting. So they're quite happy they're delayed, and they've put some good tunes on the radio. They're singing along. They're perfectly happy in their traffic jam. So it's not the traffic jam that's causing the problem, because otherwise we'd all respond the same way, right? It's the thinking we apply to the event that then makes us feel a certain way that leads to behaviour. And then I rush into work, hence my rushing analogy right at the start, is I would be sat in the car feeling rushed, even though I'm stationary, get into work, can't find a parking space because I'm the last in the office, and then I have to park far away as, you know, possible from the office. And I'm literally running into the office and running into a meeting room. And actually, that's what probably looks unprofessional, is me blustering in, really stressed. But and so you can see how that that think, feel, do kind of model manifests itself. And if I could have just shifted the thinking and thought, you know what, I'm going to be a bit late here. That's okay. It happens. I can't control the traffic. I'm probably going to turn up in a much clearer state of mind. I'm going to be much calmer. My entrance is going to be a little bit more professional. And it's not a big deal. But I can't, so, yeah, it's a really fascinating kind of concept to think about, that the event itself is not the trigger. It's the thinking I'm applying to it and the emotions it's triggering in me. That
and your hurry-up drivers. Reaction.
My hurry-up driver. And my people pleaser. Don't want to be late. Don't want to let people down. So, yeah, you can see how those drivers then start to play out and affect our thinking. And it's just noticing it and just going, oh, I can. It's almost like the monkey on your shoulder, you know, the voice on your shoulder, the little monkey in your brain that's sort of chipping away at you and just going, oh, here it is again. I recognise it. You can go away now. I know what you're trying to do here. And just sort of try and counter it and just see if you can change your thinking into a more helpful state.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's you know, it's one of the things I remember from when we have worked together is you're really good at that. Getting those really practical things that make those principles kind of bring it to life, because that I'm sure there's I really resonate with that. I'm sure people listening are kind of resonating with that, you know, those are very common things and we all do it sometimes, but it's just kind of, as you say, recognizing it and seeing how you're gonna look at it differently. So listen, I'm conscious of time and I think that probably that's as much as we can cover in this episode, but I feel like there's quite a lot more we'd like to kind of reflect on and digest from what you've said. So it'd be great if we could get you to come back a later episode if you've got time, Jill. Would that be okay?
Perfect. Yeah, be very happy to.
I got more questions. Yeah, more questions.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a coach. I love questions. Keep them coming. That's what it's all
exactly.
about.
Exactly. It's one of those things, when I've discovered this stuff, it was like someone just put a light bulb in my mind. And all of a sudden, my holiday reading is all like self-improvement, but I've just become such a like product, you know, bore about those sort of things. So it's fascinating stuff.
It's fascinating. And once I've got plenty of book recommendations, Alex, if you need. You can see the bookshelf behind me maybe on this call, but I've got lots of books I can recommend if ever you run out.
That's a good point. We'll stick them in the description of the podcast on this episode as well for anyone else who might be interested. So listen, thank you so much again, Jill, for your time. It's been really, as always, really, really interesting to talk to you and really, really helpful. So look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thank you again.
Great. Thanks a lot, Jill. It was great to meet you. Thanks
everyone for listening. Cheers then. Take care. Bye.